Welcome to the Watchdog on Mint Press with me, Loki. This week, we are joined by the comedic extraordinaire, Amer Rahman. Amer, how are you doing?
Good, bro. Good. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us. This week, we are all reeling from the news. The NSO Group's Pegasus spyware seems to have been used on around 50,000 people across the planet. We are talking the phones of activists, journalists, politicians, hacked. No comedians so far. What are you saying about that, Amer?
Bro, if they've hacked the auntie's WhatsApp group, that may be our best weapon against them. Because there's no further level of misinformation that they're going to find than the fake news in the Desi Auntie's WhatsApp groups.
Also, we have seen that Ben & Jerry's, the ice cream company, have ceased selling their ice cream in illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. We know that those settlements are illegal according to UN Resolution 2334. And also, when you look at business activities within those settlements, through contributing to the economy within them, they are perpetuating what is understood to be an illegal situation by Amnesty International and many others. Of course, the state of Israel has responded in a characteristically healthy way by describing this as a form of terrorism and claiming that it will begin an aggressive campaign against ice cream. Also, writing to states in the US where their lawfare tactics through proxy pressure groups were able to force legislation against BDS, appealing to those states to punish Ben & Jerry's. The Interior Minister of Israel has, of course, reacted in a very healthy way, turning up at a Ben & Jerry's factory inside the Green Line to hold a press conference, holding a tub and threatening Ben & Jerry's, all completely normal behavior. Meanwhile, the Ben & Jerry's Israel account seems to be retweeting Israeli government claims that the company is choosing terror. Seems like a bit of Stockholm syndrome there. Any comment, Amer?
Listen, bro, I think, we've had the war on drugs, the war on terror. The real enemy, as we know, has been ice cream. So good for Israel. As you said, very healthy behavior. But also, bro, I mean, it's good. It's good that Ben and Jerry's are taking this position, but I'm also skeptical of this kind of corporate social responsibility, which can be a bit shallow at times. So until there's a Kanafa flavor, or until they release a proper red, green, and white, tribute to Palestine, I'm holding my breath.
Yeah, they haven't gone far enough, right? So Amer, as a comedian interacting with the world on the remains of a genocided indigenous population in Australia, how does it feel?
It's a good question. I mean, it's a constant tension. You know, you're living in a place where, you know, people find Australia hard to understand because it's so far away, it's so isolated, and its representations are so banal. And it's beaches and sunshine and, you know, the crocodile hunter or home and away. But really, Australia is a unique experiment in white supremacy. It's like the Delta variant of white supremacy got left on an island for, you know, a few hundred years to mutate. And people just don't understand, unless you've really traveled around the West, how different it is culturally.
I mean, of course, we know that Winston Churchill referred to Australians during the Second World War of being of bad stock. We know that around 150,000 people were transported there in chains. You know, many of the Irish that arrived were in leg irons. The Germans who came were later referred to by some as 10-pound poms. You have Vietnamese settling in Australia referred to as quote-unquote boat people. Let's not forget that in 1834, when the British supposedly abolished slavery within the British Empire, of course, as we know, it was a transfer of wealth from the public of £20 million at that time. Some estimate it as being around £2 billion in today's money from the public to the people that owned human beings as a form of compensation for quote-unquote lost property. However, in Australia, 40 years after the British Emancipation Act, you still had the practice of slavery existing. For me, I very much view the relationship between Britain and Australia, especially up until the Second World War, but obviously until today in many ways, to be very much an umbilical kind of relationship. You had Australians fighting for the British in China in the Boxer Rebellion in order to maintain the spoils of the Opium War and to maintain the trade in heroin in China that the British forced. You also had them fighting in New Zealand for the British, in South Africa for the British, in World War I and World War II for the British, and even in Malaya for Clement Attlee, the much celebrated Labour Prime Minister of this country. The war in Malaya really for the benefit of the rubber tycoons in Britain actually led to British soldiers chopping off the heads of Malayan rebels and taking pictures with them and displaying them. We know that the Australians also on that changeover from really British domination of the world to US domination fought in the Korean War, in which 3 to 4 million people were killed. They even fought in Vietnam for the United States and were part of the Phoenix program that was linked to 30 to 50,000 deaths of Vietnamese people, mostly civilians. And in fact, Ted Sarong, the commander of the Australian Army training team, said, "We did kill teachers and postmen. They were part of Viet Cong infrastructure." What you also have Australia carrying the honor of being is the first country to produce the uranium for nuclear bombs, which were then tested on Australia by the British. And again, the original request for that came from Clement Attlee. At that time, when the bombs were tested on Australian land, there were 13 Aboriginal communities within 200 miles of the testing ground. And it wasn't until those British Army personnel involved in the test began to be struck down with cancer that more serious interrogation was directed toward the effect of that nuclear testing on the community around it. Let's not forget that a third of a milligram of plutonium increases a person's chance of cancer by around 50%. When we look at Australia's relationship with Britain, as somebody that lives there, that's grown there, that works there and makes comedy there, how do you view it, Amar?
You're absolutely right that, you know, we're talking about a British colonial outpost in the heart of Southeast Asia. And it has functioned always as a colonial outpost. And the psyche of the nation is that of, you know, one of this kind of inverted notion of invasion. A country that's permanently terrified of being invaded, but refuses to acknowledge that its very existence is the result of a brutal invasion, which you cannot really describe in modern day terms. If you look at a pre-colonial map of Australia, of a continent of that size, the number of different nations and cultural groups and cultures that existed before white invasion, really, like the only kind of modern day way of explaining the level of devastation and decimation would be like a nuclear attack on a continent today, in terms of the not simply like the people, but the environmental damage, permanent environmental damage and changes that were done to the entire continent. So, you know, Australia is a place that just lives in, like, you know, like most Western nations, in a state of denial. But again, I would say in Australia, there's been a sort of kind of cultural resistance, even to token kind of efforts to reconcile the past. And, you know, of course, we talk about, you know, the invasion and displacement of First Nations, of Indigenous people. But also, if you look at immigration to Australia, we had the White Australia policy, which was in effect until the late 60s, early 70s. So if you compare just to a place like Britain, where regardless of history, black and brown people have a presence in the UK now going back 4 or 5 generations, My family didn't arrive in Australia until the late 80s. Most African communities didn't arrive until the 90s. So there's a giant gap post-invasion where the continent is really just white people and, you know, now a minority of decimated First Nations. And that does, I think, something very particular to the psyche of the country and to people's general attitude towards race and history.
I mean, it strikes me as a place which is constantly at war with its own geography. In 1947, Arthur Calwell, the immigration minister, put it this way: we have 25 years to populate this country before the yellow races are down upon us. Of course, we have much in common with you, as Rupert Murdoch owns about 2/3 of all newspaper distribution in Australia, and we share him really in common. We have to also...
A Commonwealth treasure.
A Commonwealth treasure, exactly. And, you know, to add to the fact that he is known to hold a lot of his earnings through this company in a very complicated web of tax havens. You know, Britain, it has a network of tax havens around the world, which equate to 38% of all losses through taxes that are put in tax havens for all governments around the world. So that's quite... an astounding legacy and relationship to have with the rest of the world. You know, as you said, Aboriginal Australians, at least according to figures from the 90s, are figured to die in police custody one on average every 14 days or so. You know, you are talking about a place that is both simultaneously seemingly at war with its history and has this sort of national pact of silence, as some put it, and at war with its geography, and considers itself part of the West, despite the fact that it is nowhere near the West and is on a globe which is constantly revolving. You know, Australia is part of the Five Eyes network with Canada, the UK, New Zealand, the United States. And what it basically means is that it facilitates the intelligence actions of both the United States and the UK within its borders. So they have no regulation really seriously under the Five Eyes program. Now, there's a well-known case where a prime minister in Australia was elected in 1972, Gough Whitlam. One of his first policies was to bring back Australian troops from Vietnam, to end conscription. It was the first time, as far as I understand, that Aboriginal people were drawn into administration of their own affairs. There was equal pay for women. Unemployment benefits rose. You had the establishment of a national health service for the first time in Australia's history. You had the abolishing of university fees. Legal aid became a universal right. The Australian anthem replaced God Save the Queen, and royal patronage was abolished. There were no more knighthoods or honours from the British Empire. What happened next?
So, yeah, Gough Whitlam's legacy in Australia is largely remembered as someone who was progressive, as you said, you know, fought for free education, access to healthcare, became critical of US expansion in Vietnam, and generally was, you know, was seen as a headache for the Nixon administration, because until then, Australia was a very reliable sort of colonial lapdog, as we've said. You know, it could be counted on to do what it was told. Now, the story of Whitlam's dismissal by the Governor General is basically, the way it's taught in Australian schools is that this was, you know, a very, you know, a scandalous and kind of quirky exercise of the Governor General's powers, which exist on paper but have never been exercised in that way and have never been exercised since. Whitlam was having trouble passing legislation and was not calling an election. The Governor General sacked him, appointed the caretaker government, and then, you know, Australia headed to a new election. But of course, other things that we now know are, of course, the fact that, you know, the Nixon administration was very unhappy with him, particularly his questioning of why Australia should be host to massive U.S. military base, which, you know, has global sort of global reach to this day. Basically, the documents were released that basically the Governor General was the CIA's man in Australia. And that, you know, Whitlam's dismissal now is hard to write off as simply, you know, a quirky kind of thing that happened in Australian politics or something that simply happened as a result of, you know, domestic friction. But, you know, that his international outlook, and, you know, I don't share the kind of the general view of Whitlam as this, you know, progressive hero, but yes, was he a radical shift, you know, in terms of what was happening at a national level at that time? Yes. And would it absolutely have threatened or upset the US at that time? Yes. So people call it a conspiracy theory. I mean, when you fly in as the US's new ambassador to Australia, the man who was responsible for the coup in Jakarta, you know, people like that don't just get flown around for holidays. You know, people are sent there for a particular purpose. And we know that diplomatic missions everywhere by every country are not simply diplomatic missions, but they're the home base for intelligence operations for that country, because, you know, they have the protection of diplomatic immunity. And obviously that's where all foreign staff are sort of headquartered.
Yeah. And I mean, the interesting thing is the Pine Gap satellite base, which on the surface of it has the PR of being a joint base between the Australians and the Americans for space research. It has been found that that base is entirely for the benefit of US surveillance. But also on top of that, you had another base, which it had been found was used in signaling and for key parts of the bombing of Cambodia, which of course had not taken place with any consultation of the Australian government. And it's quite ironic that Victor Marchetti, who was a former senior CIA officer, put it like this. He said, "It was exactly like Chile, but more sophisticated and a subtle form," when he was comparing the coup that took place against Salvador Allende in Chile and the coup that took place against Gough Whitlam in Australia. Now, it's ironic that he mentions Chile, because an element of Australian intelligence, the ASIS, worked with the CIA in Chile to destabilize the country under Allende. So clearly, we see this idea of a good example being the enemy of US imperialism around the world, and clearly those movements were taken against the government in even a place like Australia. Now, when we think about the relationship
just another piece of trivia is that Whitlam refused to have his staff vetted by ASIO, which is our internal security service. So he was definitely willing to be at odds with, you know, he was not making friends with intelligence circles at the time. And I think another reason that, you know, it's not taught as history, even for people who know about the history of the CIA or know about the history of the US's involvement across the global South, is because, you know, it didn't happen with death squads, and it didn't happen, you know, as a reaction to the, you know, far leftist movements or, you know, people's movements. It's, you know, on the scale of the things the CIA has done in terms of toppling governments or removing leaders, it's definitely at the much more quieter, civilized end. And it also has the perfect smokescreen, which is this whole story about, you know, the disillusion of a double disillusion election and, you know, basically Whitlam's inability to pass legislation. So yeah, it's interesting that it really doesn't get its own chapter in CIA history the way, you know, many other situations have.
And you've also said previously, especially when considering, you know, a place like Bangladesh, country of origin for yourself, really under threat from climate change. It's in a very precarious position. But you've compared the population of Bangladesh being 160 million people in a place the size of Tasmania. Of course, the entire indigenous population really were wiped out by their contact with the British Empire in Tasmania, something that they don't teach in schools here. But you compared that 160 million people in a place the size of Tasmania to 20 million people on a place almost the size of North America in Australia, and really to point out how ridiculous it is that asylum seekers, that refugees attempting to come to Australia are being placed offshore in really fearsome detention centers. What do you say about that?
Well, yeah, it goes back to our original conversation, you know, perpetual fear of invasion. And really the history of Australia's modern detention regime around asylum seekers happens in 2001, where, and this was, you know, this was purely luck on the part of the conservative government at the time, but in August and September, boats with asylum seekers started arriving towards Australia. And really, as a total publicity stunt, then Prime Minister John Howard was using the SAS, which is the Australian Special Forces, to board the ships. And we're talking ships with people who were, you know, sometimes close to death after making these sort of perilous voyages. But of course, it was this whole kind of, you know, for the sake of media spectacle and to kind of drum up the idea that these people are a threat to us, and that, you know, that, you know, we don't know where they've come from and we don't know what they're planning here. Of course, when 9/11 happens, this becomes just the perfect opportunity now to basically fuse these two narratives of refugees being a threat and, you know, what is then going to turn into the totally, you know, never-ending expansion of so-called sort of counterterrorism legislation and this entire homeland security apparatus that has only grown since. So Australia really has been, again, a testing lab for how cruelly you can treat basically the world's most vulnerable people. Not only how cruelly you can treat them, but how much you can exploit that treatment for votes, and how much you can basically numb a population to the torture and incarceration and brutality that you subject these people to. That's really it. And for many years, not recently, like for many years, European governments have openly, not secretly, openly studied Australia's approach and openly discussed how they can implement Australia's various processes of detention, offshore detention, the idea that people are coming to seek asylum in your country, but you're not going to allow them to set foot on your soil. Australia even did insane kind of legal gymnastics where they was called excising territory. So even if you physically made it to Australian land or waters, as a result of the way in which you came, you would be deemed as not having arrived and therefore not being able to submit an asylum claim.
Yeah, and I mean, that first Norwegian ship that came, the MV Tampa, after having to wait for a very, very long time, it was sent to the island of Nauru. And the operation that was launched was called Operation Relics, which was put in place until 2007. And what happened then was the offshore processing situation was temporarily ended really in 2008. But then later on, you had in 2010, the pushing of this idea of the Malaysia solution, where there would be almost a swap of people from Malaysia that would come to Australia in return for a far amount of refugees basically being swapped and put in Malaysia. Eventually, it fell through and did not happen. But what you had really in place was this idea that the Australian Navy would force back boats if they entered Australian waters. You'd have people turned away at the airports if they came without a visa. You, of course, had people sent to Papua New Guinea and Nauru. And then the operation that they called Operation Sovereign Borders, It was basically a revamp of Relics. And what then you had taking place was not only the Australian government running information campaigns to propagandize to people outside of Australia not to come, but you also had airline liaison officers hired by the Australian government to be on planes and spot passengers who they thought might be coming to claim asylum, and actually even prevent those people they suspected from boarding planes towards Australia. You know, as we've said, the conditions in these detention centers, and, you know, let's not forget that the UK, the US and Australia are the only countries that do not have any limit on the amount of time that they can detain people in migration cases for. But in 2015, you had the well-known Islamophobe and racist Katie Hopkins, who, in fact, in an article in The Guardian, claimed that she signed a 35-year contract with British military intelligence. Remember, this was a woman who trained at Sandhurst and had her university education paid for by the British Army. She claims that the only reason she's not in the British Army today is because she suffers from epilepsy. Well, she, in this now famous article in The Sun, which of course is owned by Rupert Murdoch, the gentleman we mentioned earlier, her article was titled "Rescue Boats, I'd Use Gunships to Stop Migrants." Now, she put it this way: "No, I don't care. Show me pictures of coffins, show me bodies floating in water, play violins and show me skinny people looking sad. I still don't care, because in the next minute you'll show me pictures of aggressive young men at Calais spreading like norovirus on a cruise ship." She goes on and on and on in this article, and she says the following: "There's no stopping them. 170,000 came last year. During a recent operation by the Italian Coast Guard to rescue migrants off the coast of Libya, the people traffickers threatened crew with Kalashnikovs to get their vessel back. Clearly, boats are in short supply, and that is a good thing. No boats, no migrants. There is a simple solution to this. It's time for the Italians to stop singing opera, drinking espresso, and looking sheath and chuffing everything. It's time to get Australian. Australians are like the British people, but with balls of steel, can-do brains, tiny hearts, and whacking great gunships." So what she's advocating here is for a policy of militarily treating people who are attempting to find a safe haven. Now, and of course, this, yeah, go ahead.
So, I mean, this goes back to 2001 with the Howard government, where they began centralization of information and command away from the Department of Defense through, directly through the Defense Minister and the Immigration Minister. So, you know, we're now 20 years later where we have Peter Dutton, who's consistently trying to consolidate Homeland Security, intelligence, and border protection under himself. That's not new. That's something that was really pioneered 20 years ago. And of course, as you said, the ability to detain people indefinitely. That was a famous 2004 case with a Palestinian man, Ahmed Katib, who was born in Kuwait, arrived in Australia, sought asylum, was denied asylum. But then under Australian law, the deal is that you're detained until we can get rid of you. Now, if you're stateless and there's nowhere to send you, then under Australian law, you can be detained until you die. And, you know, these things are normal in Australia. These things are not a matter of debate anymore. So, again, you know, the idea of turning boats back at gunpoint, I mean, these are things that Australia started, you know, in the early 2000s. And as you said, Operation Relics, it's just such a horrific combination of aggression and intentional neglect, because Relics was basically a massive surveillance operation to know exactly when and where boats were in Australian waters. And, you know, boats were given, you know, serial code numbers, suspected illegal entry vessel and the number. So CIVX was suspected illegal entry vessel 10, And we now know that the Australian government had knowledge that the boat was in Australian waters, that it was in distress, that it had over 300 people on it, and they drowned. Only 44 people survived. And that was simply because the Australian government intentionally refused to send aid and 100% thought that they were sending a message. You know, as you said, Kamala Harris recently did a speech where, you know, she said, you know, if you have loved ones who are trying to get here, do not come, do not come, do not come. And, you know, it's interesting how the narrative, the rhetoric has shifted to, you know, we're thinking about your safety. We don't want people to drown at sea. But these are the people who have let people drown at sea. You know, it's completely fake. But what it reminded me of when Kamala Harris said, don't come, there's a famous photo, and it's a harrowing photo, because the Australian government produced billboards and videos of sharks and crocodiles in water, and basically to send out to Asia, saying that, you know, if you come here, you might die at sea, all these things might happen. There's a photo of a bomb blast in Quetta where people's bodies are being dragged away from a blast site. And in the background of the blast site is an Australian government billboard saying, don't come.
Wow.
I mean, these are what, you know, politicians refer to as the push factors. When you see them on, you guys call it question time, we call it Q&A. They'll sanitize these things and say, well, the push factors are dictating greater population flows. So they're talking about war and terror and famine and the things that make people risk their lives. So, you know, that photo says everything. You know, the government claims that these people shouldn't live in fear, and their own billboard is overlooking a place where people have been, you know, massacred on the basis of their ethnicity, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And Katie Hopkins, in this now deleted article after a lot of public pressure, said the following: make no mistake, these migrants are like cockroaches. They might look a bit like Bob Geldof's Ethiopia circa 1984, but they are built to survive a nuclear bomb. They are survivors. Once gunships have driven them back to their shores, boats need to be confiscated and burned on a huge bonfire. Drilling a few holes in the bottom of anything suspiciously resembling a boat would be a good idea. Unless we take the emotion out of this and start connecting the migrants in the Med with the Africans clinging to trucks in Calais, we cannot deliver an appropriate response. If you think rescue boats are a good idea, you may as well set up a Libya to Italy P&O ferry service and send your taxes to Africa by direct debit for good measure. Now, this repulsive and horrific person obviously still has a channel on YouTube, still has an Instagram account. All of these things are important when we think of the censorship of Palestinian voices on a daily basis and other voices who support the rights of Palestinians, and also left-wing accounts that have been shut down by big major tech companies. Some of the technology that has been provided to surveil the movement of boats has been purchased from Elbit Systems, the Israeli arms company, by the British government. What we also see is Katie Hopkins has been funded by Robert Shilman, formerly on the board of directors for the Friends of the IDF. He also funds that organization alongside the building of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank through an organization known as the Jewish National Fund, but previously called the Jewish Colonial Fund. She then worked for Rebel Media, which is funded by the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Now, that organization also shares funders with the Henry Jackson Society, the Center for Security Policy, who initiated the Muslim ban under Trump, and the Friends of the IDF. Now, this organization that funds both the David Horowitz Freedom Center and the Henry Jackson Society is the Herzog Family Foundation. But the Henry Jackson Society are famous for pushing the project of student rights in this country, which led to the PREVENT program. Now, do you know who has been on the political council of the Henry Jackson Society? None other than Priti Patel. the very same Priti Patel who had over 10 meetings with Israeli figures from the Israeli government, including the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, without telling the British government at the time. These were secret meetings. And after 13 days in the state of Israel, that she claimed were merely part of a family holiday, she had wanted to give British aid money to the Israeli army in the occupied Golan Heights in Syria. Now, where we see an alignment between Priti Patel and Katie Hopkins is not just in their admiration for the apartheid state of Israel, but also in the adopting of a Katie Hopkins-like plan for migration in Britain. It was, of course, Priti Patel that was the first person in government who came up with the idea of using Navy boats to turn back refugees coming to the UK. Now, let's remember that that is a direct application of what Katie Hopkins was suggesting in this now deleted article. Refugees in this country are only 0.18% of the population. If they do have recourse to public funds, it's only £37.75 weekly. That's just over £5 a day. Many of them don't have recourse to public funds. Well, Priti Patel was actually paid £1,000 an hour as an advisor to a company called Viasat. Viasat's satellite systems are used in Royal Navy warships. That's just an interesting convergence, it seems. Under Priti Patel's new immigration plans, you have people that have taken quote-unquote unauthorized routes being denied an automatic right to asylum. You also see the possibility that people can be imprisoned for up to 4 years for entering the country unlawfully. And of course, Priti Patel is pushing this idea of having refugees and migrants processed offshore from Britain. This is Katie Hopkins in brown face. This is the application of a policy which leads, in many cases, to death, suffering, misery, and despair. If you had a message for Priti Patel, Ahmed, what would it be?
Well, I don't know if you know, but I regularly refer to Priti Patel as Cousin Fair and Lovely. Just going back to what you really highlighted exactly what it is, because you can say all the stats and you can tell people that, you know, the number of people that you think are coming, it's the amount of money and resources that you think are being channeled their way, is it? But you know, at the end of the day, when you have that kind of language, that genocidal language, when you call people cockroaches, when you say they're another species and they can survive anything, and you know, they need to be over there and in their war-torn whatever and not over here, and you know, we need to basically wipe them out, it's irrelevant. You know, when you can dehumanize people to that degree, it's totally irrelevant. And you know, people might be wondering how these kind of policies have been normalized in Australia for this long. And that's simply because the opposition, you know, Australia's supposedly center-left opposition, has never dared to oppose it. And they couldn't because the Australian Labor Party are the ones who, in fact, introduced mandatory detention. The policy of mandatorily detaining anyone seeking asylum was a Labor Party policy, which itself violates the most basic rights of anyone seeking asylum. But then in 2001, during that election campaign, when, you know, the Howard government was just, you know, going, you know, completely guns blazing with this kind of rhetoric of, you know, we will decide who comes to this country and under what circumstances, they just didn't have the backbone to oppose it. And then, you know, the times that they have been in power, they've simply adopted the same thing. There's a handshake agreement now. There is total political consensus across the board in Australia that mandatory detention And this kind of, you know, this kind of concentration camp approach to asylum seekers cannot be bucked. Like this is just a normality. For Priti Patel to be advocating for it is completely natural. It's completely natural because Australia is the laboratory. And when you have people like Katie Hopkins doing the groundwork, selling the ideology, normalizing it, broadcasting it, then, you know, Priti Patel, she's just the cherry on top. She's just the final rubber stamp on now we're going to make this, we're just going to make this legal.
Well, of course, it's lucky that when Captain Cook sailed from the shores of England to what would later become Australia, but what was at that time hundreds of Aboriginal nations, it's lucky he came with a passport, right?
Of course, yeah, and old documents. And of course, it was when he showed those documents in Hawaii that he was ultimately murdered and eaten. So good on him.
Well, of course, when thinking about this imbalance with which it's presented, that literally 0.18% of British society are refugees. 80% of refugees are in developing countries, not in the countries like Australia or Britain. How is it that somebody like Rupert Murdoch has been able to stir such hatred towards this supposed maldistribution of resources towards the most vulnerable and poorest, when he, for 11 years, it seemed to have been effectively avoiding paying any corporation tax in Britain, despite making billions there through his news and TV empire? This is what you call vertical solidarity and horizontal hatred. And the production and the manufacturing of that is a very sophisticated machine with a lot of different cogs in it. Now, I've also heard that you have a problem with the new CBS series, The United States of Al. Can you tell me about that, please?
I mean, if I could just go back to your last point, you know, how is it that Rupert Murdoch rate and enjoy Al or Bezos or any of these people or Elon Musk enjoy this kind of, you know, celebrity status as, you know, completely unaccountable billionaires while, you know, the most vulnerable people in the world are constantly subjected to this kind of hatred? I mean, that's part of the pact of whiteness, is that, you know, you're more willing to believe that your conditions are the result of non-white people stealing from you than the fact that rich white people are scamming you. That's really it. That, you know, nobody wants to really admit that they've been completely hoodwinked, you know, and that's what whiteness offers, is this kind of fig leaf of superiority that allows you to think that somehow you're on the winning team when you're not.
Mm. And so then to this United States of Owl on CBS, what's your problem with it?
Look, bro, the fact that I wasn't given an opportunity to audition for an Afghan interpreter on a sitcom, for one, given that they clearly weren't worried about casting a real Afghan for the part. Bro, I mean, honestly, when I saw that, I mean, I'm used to like bad and racist content. Yeah, as someone who's in like comedy and, you know, on the periphery of that industry, like I'm used to it. But this is so crass. It's so terrible on so many different levels, right? I mean, you know, some people's initial complaint was that the main character is not being played by an Afghan, to which I said, listen, it doesn't matter.
First, just tell us what it is. Tell us what the show is.
The premise of the sitcom is that there's an American soldier who comes back from his tour in Afghanistan, and basically the Afghan man who used to interpret for him while he was a soldier there comes to settle in the USA, and they, you know, he takes him in and he lives in his house, and he begins to, you know, this kind of quirky journey of, you know, assimilating into American culture. I mean, when I first saw the trailer, I was just shocked. I just thought, how is this, you know, if this happened in 2005, maybe, but in 2020, it's quite remarkable. And like I said, people were upset because the guy who plays the main Afghan character is, he's South African Indian. And people were like, this is not authentic. And I think even if it was, I'm pretty sure if there was an Afghan playing this part, it would be just as horrific. I mean, that's the least of our worries. But, I mean, where to begin? You know, the idea that, I mean, he's really the whole premise of the sitcom, because it plays on comedic tropes, is that he's this fish out of water, and but he's a noble, you know, he's a noble native informant, because he's the guy who protected this white American soldier, you know, while he was in danger over there, and he's one of the good ones because he worked with us. And you know, the jokes are just one after another about his culture and how he doesn't get things. And you know,
of course it comes from the well-known anti-racist at the Big Bang Theory. So we have high expectations.
Well, this is, I mean, you know, the Big Bang Theory is, you know, there's an Indian character on there as well, which is, you know, again, just a pile of gross racist stereotypes. And the format itself is just like this outdated 90s sitcom. And I haven't seen any episodes, but I saw a clip online, which is just like every extra second of this that I see is just more infuriating. But the scene that I watched is basically the U.S. soldier and his Afghan friend go out. The soldier gets slightly drunk, so the Afghan guy has to drive, and he doesn't have a license. So they get pulled over by a black cop. The black cop is interrogating them, asking for his license. And then the first big joke is that the Afghan guy, instead of pulling out any identification, pulls out money because he's going to bribe the cop. Then the cop gets very offended. You're trying to bribe me. And the soldier realizes the cop is a veteran because of a badge or something that he's wearing. And he tells him that he was in the army. I was in the army too. I'm really sorry. This won't happen again. And it's all taken care of. I mean, given the state of police brutality in the United States, I mean, it's beyond fantasy. It's really beyond fantasy. And it's, but, and we might dismiss it, but it's very effective propaganda, because it's not designed for you and me. It's designed for a mainstream American audience to remind them that it wasn't a problem that we went to Afghanistan in, you know, in the year that we're going to withdraw after not nation building for 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, also the crude identity politics sides of it is simply for representation, that there should be an Afghan actor playing the Afghan translator in this sitcom. However, the wider point being made, as you've pointed to, is that not only is there something natural about US imperialism imposing itself on a country that was occupied four times over the last 200 years by the British, where the Durand line was drawn between what was at that time India and Afghanistan. And today the fault lines really that show themselves in Afghanistan are largely a product of that residue of colonial projections of British power. But basically that this relationship is somehow natural, normal, and that it's very much like a everybody sit round in a circle, hold hands, and sing Kumbaya. It's the sort of United Colors of Benetton of US imperialism. But the CBS channel has a history with this kind of embarrassing imperialism. We saw in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, an interview by Dan Rather, the CBS News presenter with Saddam Hussein. Now, the translator in this interview was a man by the name of Steve Winfield. Now, Steve Winfield was a US citizen who spoke, as it is described in an article, in everyday North American accent. However, in the interview, his translation of what Saddam Hussein is saying is in a sort of fake Arabic accent. And so it just comes across as extremely cringy. Now, the reaction of CBS News to this coming out and being problematized in the press was the translation was 100% accurate and the voice is a voice compatible with the piece. So clearly, CBS News have a very have a very healthy attitude to all these kind of things. Have you ever been asked to do any voiceovers before?
Look, not like that. Look, bro, I mean, you know, we shouldn't criticize CBS for trying to approximate representation when there are no brown people available. I mean, you can't write comedy like that. That's incredible that he would actually put on an accent while translating. But I was just going back to the fact that, you know, just discussing pop culture in Afghanistan. Have you seen Rambo 3?
I haven't, no.
Do you know what it's about?
Tell me. I have no idea.
Rambo 3 is about Rambo fighting alongside the Mujahideen to expel the Soviets from Afghanistan.
Wow.
It is, I mean, there's a scene where Rambo is introduced by a tribal leader who says, "These are the Mujahideen. We've taken our last rights. This is a holy war for our land and country. And there's no greater honor." It's absolutely valorizing them. And there's long speeches from Americans against the evil Soviets saying, "You don't know what you've gotten yourself into. This is your Vietnam. Your war machine will never succeed against this resistance movement." It's truly incredible. And as if the movie is not enough, at the end, there's an entire screen that says dedicated to the gallant people of Afghanistan.
I mean,
just to show you how Hollywood is able to completely morph according to, you know, whatever the military's, whatever the Department of Defense's line is of the day.
Yeah. I mean, you've also got to admire how well it's able to reproduce itself. So what we do learn is that the system can't assimilate major changes towards social justice, but what it can do is kill you and then 40 years later make a film about your life and about you being killed and then sell that, repackage that and sell
that. Absolutely.
I mean, and in the case of Black Panther, somehow they've managed to create the notion in young people's minds across the world that Black Panthers were helped by the CIA rather than conspired against by the CIA and strategically killed.
The CIA was live tweeting Black Panther when it was released.
So the
Department of Defense's involvement in Hollywood. I mean, it's, you know, there's actually an interview with Phil Straub, who was the DOD liaison with Hollywood for 20 years. He's not now. And his departure was very quiet, and I don't know what happened, but he does an interview basically with a young class of filmmakers. And he's very open about what his job is. And he talks about how, you know, they'll rewrite entire storylines. In the film Godzilla, the military character was not sympathetic. So they rewrote him as a family man and all this kind of stuff. And he's not apologetic or embarrassed at all about what he's doing. And he talks about how he was talking to the producer of Jurassic Park 3, reading the script. And at the end of the script, he said, "Hey, do you want some Marines to come and rescue people at the end?" And they were like, "Yeah, sure." And if you watch Jurassic Park 3, at the end, out of nowhere, Marine gunships appear and rescue everyone. And it's, you know, it's this perfect relationship for Hollywood because, I mean, the whole thing is based on the fact that they don't have to then pay for expensive military equipment. So, well, you know, the Department of Defense has this kind of carrot in front of producers all the time, which is, "Hey, just change this or change this or change this, and you've got millions of dollars of free toys to play with."
I mean, in the case of Independence Day, the Will Smith film, the first one, I remember that when they wanted to get some equipment, they sent it to the US military and they read the script and they said, again, like you said, there's not a character in this that actually presents us in a good light. Add a character. They literally introduced a whole new character into the Independence Day film in order to get the free use of equipment. So it's quite a clever and well put together system. Bro, it's been so great to have you. We could talk all day. I feel like we've only just We've only just scratched the surface. Maybe we'll have to bring you back for another time when you have the opportunity. Thank you so much for joining us. I really, really appreciate it. Please let people know where they can see your work and keep in touch with what you're doing.
You can just find me on Twitter, Amer_Rahman, or just search me up on YouTube. Those are the. I'm working on a website. 10 years into my career, I'm still working on a website.
I know the feeling, bro. I know the feeling.
Thanks for having me, bro. My pleasure. Thanks so much. Anytime. Happy to come back anytime.
Nice one, bro. Thank you.